Hi, everyone. My name is Zach Sherman, and welcome back to Handling the Heat, the podcast by restaurantequipment.bid, where we dive into the real stories behind the people powering the food service industry. Today, I'm joined by Graham and Allie Green, a married duo who met at the Culinary Institute of America and went on to cook at some of the most demanding, detail-obsessed, Michelin-starred restaurants in the country. Together, they've lived the full arc of fine dining, the full shifts in the walk-in, the hyper-obsessive craft, and the pressure cooker culture that pulls people in young and keeps them striving for more. We talk about the moment they realized that chasing stars and accolades was not the only, or even the best, version of a life in food, and how that realization led to Green Food, their Bay Area-based private dining and corporate meal service, as well as Jensen Ceramics, Allie's dinnerware studio, whose pieces now appear in Michelin-starred restaurants. They share what it means to build a creative life on their own terms, how they approach hospitality without the traditional restaurant model, and why making things at scale can be just as artistic as making things by hand. It is a conversation about craft, partnership, reinvention, and carving out a sustainable path in an industry that rarely teaches you how to build one. Let's dive into it. Graham and Allie, super excited to have you on the podcast. Really appreciate both of you spending some time and chatting with me today.
Yes, hello.
It's great to see you.
Cool. So the first thing we ask everybody is, what's something you've eaten recently that you've really enjoyed?
My first thought is In-N-Out.
Yeah.
Chefs, they're just like us.
Yeah. We're all the same.
My answer would be we have these friends who own a bakery in San Francisco called Bread Belly, and they make this like shrimp witch sandwich. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if the fish fillet was made out of shrimp. So it's like chopped up shrimp, like in a patty, breaded with panko on a bun with like avocado and stuff. That's my answer. So now you're on the gun.
Oh God. I have recently in the last year or two, changed to a gluten-free diet, absolutely not by choice. And I have been like smelling all of his glutinous foods for the last 2 years. And the other day I had made this apple pie for an event we had done. And I had put a whole bite in my mouth, given it a chew, and then spit it out. After flushing my mouth out with water, and I truly believe it was like the best apple pie I've ever made. And I'm really grateful that I had sacrificed my guts for one bite.
Yeah. No, I was going to say the In-N-Out sounded like a fair answer, honestly, from Jeff.
But In-N-Out.
Yeah.
That's definitely our most frequented restaurant.
Protein style for Allie, maybe.
Yes. Protein style, chilies, pickles, and onions.
I usually do some protein style, some animal style, a mix.
Just when you need to get some gluten in. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm super excited to have you on. This is our second couple guest grouping that we have here on the podcast, which is exciting. And even though you both, you know, come from different places, I feel like your entry into the food space obviously was similar, given that you met at the CIA. But I'm curious, because that's such a kind of early part of life to like choose that route. For both of you, what was the draw from not necessarily, you know, going to the CIA, which I think is, you know, somewhat obvious, but like, what was the draw to cooking and food in the first place for each of you?
Do you want to go first?
I can go first. Yeah. Well, I guess it's always easier to answer questions like that with decades of hindsight, but it's just sort of like the perfect fit for me. I was never a super engaged student. I'm not a good fit really for jobs that require a lot of sitting down or being at the computer. I kind of need like the intensity and the urgency and honestly the stress to be fully engaged. But yeah, at a really young age, I got pretty engrossed by like the Food Network. And then I started reading like chef memoirs of people who had opened like extremely ambitious restaurants. I was just always drawn to this idea of like people getting together and sacrificing a ton to pursue a common goal, even when that goal like didn't involve a big payout. There was something attractive to me about that at a young age. And then obviously you get older and you realize like that doesn't necessarily afford you the type of life that you think you might want when you're 18.
Sure.
But yeah, so I think for me, that was probably the big draw. And then just cooking at a young age, it was kind of like the first thing that gave me self-confidence. I like had a knack for it and have a fairly obsessive personality. And so I really just dove in. It was like, while I should have been paying attention in class, I was reading cookbooks and cooking in my time off. And then once I was of legal age, started working in restaurants and then like kind of managed to sneak my way into a restaurant I was like totally unqualified to work at while I was a teenager in New York. And yeah, the rest is history. I tried some other things too, tried working in tech and stuff, and then got like quickly reminded why why I was a good fit for cooking in the first place.
Awesome.
I think kind of leaping off of that, I had a similar love for food, but I think is much less obsessive, studious, and much more gluttonous. I really just wanted to eat as much sugar as I could possibly manage. And so
still do.
I enjoyed baking because I could have a two dozen cookies instead of one. But then also the love of sharing the cookies is like such a high. And I would, in middle school, I'd like bake brownies, and I was known for my brownies in middle school as like a 13-year-old girl. And I would bring them to school and give them to all of my friends. And it was like a huge rush to be able to bring something to friends that I created and it be so such a highly coveted item. It was very exciting. And then, Food Network growing up and watching TV, food was a very centric part of my life growing up. And then again, cooking, and it's just a really rewarding job. Like everybody has to eat, and it's really satisfying to provide sustenance that's like truly enjoyable and brings people a lot more than just nourishment. And that high of taking care of people and making sure that everyone's got everything they need and more and is happy about it all is like very exciting.
I guess that's one other thing that drew me to it. I think nowadays there aren't a huge number of career paths that are really focused around developing a craft. Well, there aren't a huge number of like responsible career paths that are around developing a craft. Like obviously you could like try to become a musician or something, but cooking is one of those things that although hard, like you can pretty immediately do that to pay your bills. And especially now, like there's a lot less, it's a lot harder for restaurants to find staff. And so it's, yeah, for me, I think I was drawn towards like the development of the craft and like the whole skill learning aspect of cooking too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing for me, especially because I am, enthusiast, not necessarily a, not necessarily for sure not a professional, is you could also get that in a non-professional setting too, right? Like even if you're learning how to bake a chicken yourself, like in your apartment or your house or whatever, like you still get a little hit of that same kind of working through something and trying to come up with what is the best thing that I can create that I feel proud of and that I can be hospitable towards the people that I'm bringing in.
Yeah. And they're really, I guess the thing for me that leaves that like still captivates me after like a decent amount of time cooking is that there's really like no end to trying to figure out how to make like the best possible chicken. Mm-hmm. You could do that for like 10 years, 20 years. And I guess like culture,
and people have,
yeah, and people do like culturally, it's a bit different, I guess, like area by area, but you watch like, I don't know, like the 50-year-old like sushi apprentice in Japan, right, who's like still like figuring out marginally better ways to prepare the rice every day.
I also heard like Ina Garten this morning on a podcast say like that it isn't necessarily about the roast chicken. It's about the community you build around that roast chicken, and that like you don't have to be a professional to create, just like you said, you don't have to be professional to enjoy that same rush of providing something for someone else. And we've been lucky enough to create a career around that focal point. And it's so we look at each other all the time and we're like, I can't believe that this is our life and that this is our job and yeah. our career and that we get to live a career focused on creativity. We give our clients almost no menu. Very rarely do we give our clients menus. We just show up and we provide this delicious meal and everyone's so stoked about it. And then from there, it really like kind of establishes this rapport with our clients where we just never have a menu and we just come up with whatever we want every time we have an event. And it's so, what a gift. Like I've never felt so positive about working in the food industry, given all the shitty stuff that comes out of like watching The Bear and everyone thinks that it is so cutthroat. And in a lot of ways it is, but I find that we've really found this niche that works for us in a way that's really nourishing. It's really exciting.
No, that's great. And before we get to the nourishing positivity of green yeah. food and Jensen Ceramics, let's talk about some of those shitty experiences that
sure,
you both, I'm sure, have had. So after the CIA, I know you both started working in, you know, pretty high-end, pretty well-established restaurants, working as, you know, working your way through a certain type of circuit and I think a certain type of career path that a lot of people work super hard to get to, and you are both no exception to that. Talk to me a little bit about the post-CIA journey that you both took to get to a point where you can be where you are now, and then we'll obviously transition to the more kind of happier days of where we are yeah. today.
Well, I think there's like a, there's this like kind of an awe-inspiring moment when you're super green in restaurants, especially high-end restaurants that are doing really innovative and interesting things where you really know nothing and you come in as this like dewy-eyed new kid who's like ready to do anything and you always get the shit end of the stick and okay, go do this thing in the walk-in for 17 hours and don't come out until it's done and it has to be perfect. And you're like, yes, chef, of course. And then you're like, oh my God. And so like, for instance, I had gone to, when we moved to San Francisco, I had staged at a handful of restaurants that I found to be really interesting. And it was crab season and I was in the basement of this restaurant and it was a 3-day stage and I was there like 12 hours a day. And there was one day where I was in the walk-in and basically one of the chefs upstairs had just broken down all this crab. And then I had to stand in the walk-in in the dark with a blue light and tweezers and pick out all the little crab shells. And I was like, oh no, this is not for me. I don't think this is what I want to be doing.
Maybe slightly less fancy.
Maybe less fancy. Yeah. Yeah. I was like, I'm fucking freezing. This sucks. I did not get the job. And I moved on to the next
restaurant. Maybe a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. Honestly, I really believe it was because it was just not what I wanted. And then I got a great job at The Progress in San Francisco. And I sat down with the chef and I was like, this is working. You're busy all the time. I know nothing. And obviously what you're doing is exactly what the city wants. And I want to know how you're doing it from start to finish. Every single station I'm going to work, every station in this restaurant, front and back of house, and I'm going to do it. And he was like, yeah, sure. Okay, whatever. And then 5 years later, I really did work every station. I bartended, I served, I helped open their second or their third restaurant. And when I left, he was like, you know, when you told me you were going to work all those stations, I really thought, like, what a fucking lie. People are always saying stuff in interviews to get the job, but I'm really proud that you actually did it. It was, and so it felt really good to hear that.
Graham, how about you? What do you like? I feel like it, and I think the other thing that's interesting too is there's so many different ways you can be a chef, and mm-hmm. you both have led very different lives in that sense of like working in startups or working in dishware for your ceramics alley and like working in like these super high end restaurants, but also like maybe slightly less high end, you know, food service type of operations. What is the allure of the very, very high end tweezer chef type of job, would you say, as relative to any of the other like infinite types of roles you could have as a chef that's, well-trained, classically trained.
Yeah, I think it's like more attractive when you're young. But there is something about those restaurants that are compromising as little as possible, if not like just compromising nothing at all. It's sort of like the Formula One of cooking, where it like doesn't really make sense as a business if you really like get in there and see how some of the things are made. It's like an unbelievable amount of labor that goes into something that oftentimes is literally one bite. And then you have to do it every day. You can't.
There's no getting ahead.
Yeah. There's like a marginal amount of getting ahead, but it's not like some engineer like makes a new component for the car and then like that's good for the season and like maybe make some extras. It's like every day you have to like complete this giant task. And the attention to detail is almost cult-like. I mean, I don't know if this is like a tired example, but even in those restaurants, like you don't tear the tape, or oftentimes you don't even like use the cutter attachment for the tape dispenser on the tape, because then it produces like jagged edges. So you have to like cut it parallel. And there's so many tiny examples of those things that go into the food, and that type of like a obsessive approach to making something that also like doesn't really matter in a way. Like it's not like being obsessive about the design for a car's airbags or something, right? It's like,
sure,
you're gonna work tirelessly like around the clock for like, I don't know, someone's birthday or anniversary dinner. And I think for me, as someone who's a bit obsessive by nature, I just found that like so compelling, because I could try to get as far down the path of like skill development and craft development as possible. But yeah, I mean, the environments are crazy, because like if you think about, there's a lot of people who are like willing to work hard to achieve a goal. But I think especially like we live in San Francisco, and the most common case of someone being willing to make like tons of sacrifices to achieve a goal is in like the startup space, where if it works out, like they plan, there's like a huge exit, and then like you can go like buy an island or something. But in the cooking space, it's really not like that. If it all works out and you end up on like the world's 50 best list and like you get 3 Michelin stars and the whole deal, you'll probably end up being like a moderately well-paid dentist in a big city. And so it's not this thing where you're going to end up having like your own private jet. And so if you think about like if you remove the financial incentive from the startup space, like the people who would be left are off would probably be like an interesting cast of characters that would feel compelled to do that with their life and make all these sacrifices.
Totally.
And like in their 50s, not necessarily even have the ability to like step away from the stove and like offload those responsibilities to people.
I was going to say, I think what's interesting is I was going to make the same kind of connection in like San Francisco as a food city, and it's hyper like obviously there's good burritos, right? And there's good like local food that are like more kind of homegrown staples. But the thing when I think of San Francisco food scene is like this super high end tweezer crab, three-day stage, 14 hours in a walk-in type of experiences that I feel like is super similar to my friends that work in the tech space that are like sleeping on the ground of an apartment that they just got because they don't have office space and they don't have time to, go to even IKEA and get like a bed delivered. Do you feel like that permeates the kind of ideal of what San Francisco is? Or is it like once you kind of get caught up in that, it's like very easy to feel like that's the only way of doing what it is you want to do, is because that's just kind of like the local aspirational kind of idea.
There's kind of like two points there. If I understand your question correctly, I don't think that startup mindset has an impact on the restaurant space. I think that culture of like fine dining restaurants actually like precedes the whole startup like internet ecosystem. I also just think if you go to the cities or the areas where people are like willing to spend more money on food, and there's like more uh attention media wise paid onto those restaurants, it just ends up filtering for like the people who are the craziest about cooking in the world. Like they'll open their restaurants there instead of in like Milwaukee, where there's like less attention paid. And at least in perspective, or with respect to like the accolades they could earn, it's like a much shorter list. But yeah, I mean, if you look like, I don't know, you read like Marco Pierre White's memoir of like he's like a chef from England. He might've been like the first British like 3-star chef. And if you read his memoir, like they were psychos back then too, like before like the whole internet boom even. There is like a weird cultural component, I think, in restaurants at that level, where any deviation, I mean, ultimately like cooking is just a blue collar job. But I think that people who work in those restaurants kind of feel like they've separated themselves from that world. And
I think almost with like an artistic pursuit.
But I think there's like, there's this cultural component where any deviation from trying to pursue like opening a 3-star restaurant is viewed as like, what are you doing? Like, And this was like an interesting experience for us, because we moved to San Francisco and then ended up meeting a lot of people who like worked in startups or, I don't know, in the tech sphere. They just had like quote unquote normal jobs for the area. And I remember we would talk to them about like, oh, you know, you could like a talented cook, like could go get a super high paying or relatively super high paying like private chef job. But like everyone looks down on that as like, I don't know, selling out or something.
Yeah.
And they would be like, well, because they don't understand, because the cultural component is just, it's really arbitrary.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're not cooking like 3-star food where the guidebooks are going to care about it, then all of a sudden your career path is like far less valuable. And,
mm-hmm.
But if you're making like way more money and have way better hours and you like still enjoy the cooking component, like who cares? But there is like, there's a lot of social pressure, at least when I was working in that area, yeah. Where it was like, oh, so-and-so is a private chef now. Like,
yeah, yeah. Or they went
and worked.
Yeah, now they're at Google. They're cooking for like tech companies or stuff like that. It is like I think there's this artistic component to it that feeds the ego of a fine dining restaurateur or fine dining restaurant line cook or whatever, chef de partie, because in a way, this is your craft. This is something we're doing that, I mean, ultimately, like Graham said, like, it doesn't matter. This is, we don't need to eat this food to sustain. It's an egregiously expensive dining experience. A lot of people can't do it. It's high luxury. I mean, in a lot of ways, it is like fine art, and it's an experience you're paying for. And so as a line cook, you put aside the hefty paycheck, you put aside the time off, you put aside all of the personal things that you would gain if you worked in like a quote unquote normal job for the pursuit of this
craft. Yeah.
And then if you deviate from that at all, that's where the social pressure of why would you be doing that? Why does that matter? Why aren't you selling your soul to the restaurant gods? Like these, you know, this lifestyle is a, well, then I guess you can't hack it sort of deal. And it's like, well, I'm getting to the point where my ovaries are aging and I'd really like to have a child. So, and I can't really do that if I'm in a restaurant.
Sure.
You know?
I think that's all fair, but you both are testaments to the fact that you can still express yourself creatively through other channels and still like feel that, you know, kind of sense of like, I have a vision that I want to put out into the world. And this is me kind of bringing that to life in a way that allows you to live the life you live. And I think, Allie, with your Jensen ceramics, especially, like that is something that like is obviously food related, but it's totally different from like, you know, artistic muscle, I guess, for you to like take something and bring it into the world and like still feel maybe not, you know, that you're sacrificing yourself to the restaurant gods, as you put it, but like you're still able to like bring something to life in a way that feels, you know, unique to you and kind of your vision. How did that come about, Allie, doing the ceramics work?
I have always had an affinity for pottery. Like growing up, every art class, there was a pottery section and I really enjoyed it. And it really played into the idea of like being able to flex in another way at the dinner table. And I get to show off like another format of art and craft that I have created. And it's also functional and beautiful. And it serves as a canvas for my food. And it was just kind of something I'd always envisioned, having a dinner party on the plates that I made with the food I made. And so when I first took my, like I took my first art class or my first pottery class when I had moved to bartending at the Progress, because at that point I was making a little more money and I had some time off, and I was like, okay, now's my time. Like, let's give it a shot. And it was, I had just a natural affinity for it. And it was just something I became obsessed with, and then was spending 20 hours a week on top of my job at the studio, just like making stuff to get better. And with that, I had started making dinnerware almost immediately, and then started kind of sharing those, that work, with the other restaurant connections that I had. And that interesting combination of pottery and cooking and the relationships that I already had with restaurants was kind of a natural progression. And then people really enjoyed looking at my work and using it. And now I'm in Michelin star restaurants.
Yeah, not to toot your horn, but I know you're in a lot of big name restaurants. How does that feel? Like Four Horsemen, right? You're also in international restaurants. I think you told me you're the dinnerware at a restaurant in Japan, like some sushi restaurant.
I made a few pieces for a restaurant in Japan, for a hotel in Shiga.
Yeah.
And now I made most of the dinnerware for a restaurant called The Happy Crane in San Francisco that just opened. And the Four Horsemen in Brooklyn. And it's really surreal. And I, rest in peace, I also did a bunch of work for Osito in San Francisco. And eating at those restaurants, it is kind of this surreal experience where I didn't pursue this right away. It was something that just kind of happened. And I think it's a testament to when you have a vision and you just kind of let it go, like let it run and see where it goes, and having confidence in knowing that like the decisions you're making are pushing you to be where you're supposed to be, having confidence in knowing that like the unknown is not something to be feared. There's been a lot of like personal growth in the last couple of years with pottery and with opening our own business and working really hard. I think there's something really powerful about just simply working hard at a craft. Like, I made this plate thousands of times at this point, and I can now produce it pretty effortlessly. And it feels good to just replicate. For me, it feels really good to replicate the same thing over and over and over again. I mean, I think that's like working in restaurants. You can't really get ahead. You make the same thing a million times every day because it's going to get eaten, and then you don't have any tomorrow, you know? And that's kind of, but what's cool about pottery is that it continues to exist, and there's like a legacy you can leave behind. And not to say that I'm like leaving a legacy necessarily, but it's very exciting to be a part of interesting restaurants in a different way now. It's very cool.
And it's nice that the thing that you're making is permanent now rather than.
Yes. Yeah. Oh man. To have.
Gonna get eaten.
Yeah. Yeah, don't go into the paper plate business, Allie.
No, certainly not.
Cool. Well, and I think, you know, what is super interesting too is like there is a lot of parallel paths between that type of creative outlet and food, obviously. And I think the other 100%. Thing too that you both exemplify is like not only this like constant pursuit of putting out something into the world that you feel confident in and like either builds your confidence or like inspires somebody else to like go do what they want to do. But I think what's cool about both of you, and obviously with Green Foods, your catering company / meal service company, is you both have this like, fuck it, let me just do this thing. Like I have an idea. Like, let me just like do what I think is the right idea. And obviously it's worked out in a bunch of different ways. So I'm curious, can you talk to me a little bit about Green Food and what the kind of initial onus of it was and now kind of where it is today in your, as I think you put it, like the happy kind of positive relative to like the in a dark walk room walk in.
Yeah.
I mean, it certainly has had its low moments.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
But
high highs and
high
tiring highs.
Yeah.
yeah. But Yeah, but basically we worked like in different capacities in the high-end restaurant space for a long time. And it just, at some point, I think this probably happens to a lot of people, but at some point you look at the people you are working for who have like achieved all the goals you could possibly want to achieve in the restaurant space. And then if they don't have a life you want, if like the whatever, like Michael Jordan of cooking of our era, like hasn't built a life that you'd want to trade for, you got to like sort of reassess. And yeah, and I don't know. So in some ways the business kind of happened organically because we had fallen into this network of people in the Bay Area that are like involved in tech or the broader like startup space. And we had cooked for them a bit. And then we were just kind of thinking like, what do we want to do next? I was working in tech at the time and it just like wasn't the ideal fit. I did really miss cooking. But the idea of opening a restaurant always just seems like, I mean, Godspeed to everyone who does it, but it just seems like a pretty tricky pursuit. If you're going to try to open a fine dining restaurant in the Bay Area, you're going to have to raise like close to seven figures. You're going to spend like mid six figures, like hiring an architecture firm to like redesign the space that you're leasing. So you're like sort of throwing that money into the wind because you don't even own the property. And then you're going to have like a crazy high rent and all this payroll. And like, it's really capital intensive. And then ends up being like low margin and it's hard to step away ever. And so we had just thought like, what if we take these dinners that we've been doing for people in the Bay that is like a fairly competent or fairly comparable food to what we had been doing in the restaurant space. Like what if we just did it in a way that doesn't have all that overhead? And then also gives us like way more agency over like when we're going to cook and not cook. And so we have a business now that I guess is most easily described as like a catering business. But we're not doing like 300-person weddings or anything. On one end, we do like high end dinners. That's closer probably to like the private dining space in a restaurant. And then on the other end, we do like a sort of corporate meal service drop off. The events thing is great, but there are some tricky components to it. We don't know like 2 months out what we're going to be doing and how busy we're going to be. And so it makes it hard to like support a staff and do all of that. But the corporate side for that is like much longer contracts, in some cases like a year or a few years. And that recurring revenue like makes it very predictable for us and will allow us to like support a staff and everything. Yeah, and we just have like tons of creative freedom. And from the business perspective, we just don't have all that overhead cost that would normally make pursuing opening a fine dining restaurant like kind of an insane. I'm stoked for people who are doing it and like for our friends that are doing it.
Please continue.
Yeah, yeah.
We love eating there.
Yeah, we love eating there. and like there are certainly winners in the space, but this just seems like a much lower risk pursuit than trying to do that. And something that I think we could also, because the other thing about the fine dining restaurant space is like, if you have one restaurant that has a certain number of tables, like you can only really scale so much before having to put another big chunk of money down to open a second location. And then you don't necessarily, I mean, in most cases, you don't gain efficiencies by opening or huge efficiencies by opening the second space. But like we aren't capped by that. Like we work in a commercial kitchen that could feed way, way, way more people than like even what we do when we're very busy. And so, it's been pretty like reinvigorating. I think maybe around the time COVID happened, like when I made a shift into the tech space, I was sort of like, I don't know if this, maybe like this cooking thing just isn't something that I can really pursue. But now it feels like we found a framework that feels like it could really grow like bigger than I expected. And we've been insanely busy. We just got to the tail end of like a 3 or 4 week work stretch that like almost killed us. But yeah. But those are good problems to have starting a new business.
Yeah, we're definitely still alive. We had a couple of days off. It was necessary.
I slept like 10 hours last night.
Yeah.
when you were like, what if we move it later? I was like, I will be waking
please
up 30 minutes before whatever time you tell me.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you chatting with me on your day off, on your R&R day. I guess I think on the high end dinner, like the dinner party, private dinner experience, that makes a ton of sense to me, given all of the experiences that you both have grown up doing and worked through. Do you still get that same kind of creative feeling from more of the corporate meal service? Like, do you get to develop a menu that you would feel like, how is the pride in product relative to other work that you've done on the corporate meal delivery side versus the, you know, high end dinner side, where you have a lot more of a, you know, like you get to like flex your muscles a little bit of like, hey, I did all this stuff. I like am trained. I not only trained at the CIA, but I worked in all these multiple Michelin star restaurants. Like, let me just cook you something, the craziest thing you've ever eaten in your own house. And then yeah, on the corporate meal side, it's like slightly different. You're not slightly, it's a totally different kind of, you know, experience that you're bringing to the table.
And I don't want to speak for both of us, but for me, it's like, it definitely is two separate tracks. Like on the really high end dinners, they're like a big creative outlet. People almost never even ask us like what we're making. And so we get to make like whatever we want. And so it's really like creatively engaging. But there is also the reality that like almost every time you're cooking like that, it requires some pretty big trade-offs. And like as two people like starting a new business, we want to eventually find a way where like the business is operating without us cooking all of the food. And it's not super feasible to take these personal relationships that we have on the private dining side and then like kind of outsource that to people that we hire and bring in. Right. You know, it doesn't really make sense because these are like pretty personal relationships. A lot of these people have become like friends over the years.
Yeah.
And to like send someone else in our place doesn't make a ton of sense. But on the corporate side, it makes the business make a lot of sense. And I do also love the cooking. Like mm-hmm. we also have like a lot of control over the menu. And so we can still make like whatever it is that we're interested in. And I don't personally, it's not as if my creative passion is like just parked in making like super complicated tiny food.
Totally.
Because we can make like barbecue or Indian food or like a huge variety of different things that I still totally do get excited about. But it's a different track for sure.
And I think that there's, even though it is a different format of cooking, it's something that like catering, for instance, especially large format or like this corporate catering we're doing, has this history of just being kind of bad and just, oh, great, office food. I love eating chicken salad sandwiches every day.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, that's just, although, I mean, I'm not hating on the chicken salad sandwich, big fan. But
when it was prepackaged like on yes. Monday and it's Friday, it's
yeah,
a different kind of.
That's just, it isn't exciting. It's not something people look forward to eating. And so it's an interesting way for us to kind of, like stretch ourselves to make something that people look forward to having and providing it in a way that's like exceptional. And so like we're always trying to, I think most people are in creative and cooking pursuits trying to make the best they can, but we are trying to, and I think succeeding at creating a meal that is of the highest standard that you can get in this format. And that is like how we've been rising above and creating this following and like yielding such incredible customers, and the guests that eat our food are constantly telling us how much they appreciate us being here. And like it feels really good, and it's an interesting way to push yourself in a new field that like otherwise is kind of stalked by people who are just food logistics companies who are just trying to make sure that everyone gets fed.
I guess the other thing that it is like creatively fulfilling for me also, though, is that I've always been really impressed by like the food companies that have gotten to a big scale. Like,
yeah,
everyone points to like the McDonald's example, but there is something like for me totally engaging about figuring out the logistics behind making food very repeatable at scale. And so this is like a very different, everything we make for the dinner parties is like extremely not scalable,
yeah.
like by definition. but figuring out how we could do, you know, like some of these offices plan to grow at a pretty insane clip. And so if we're doing 10 meals a week right now, it's for, you know, 35 or like 70 people. Like, what happens if it doubles a couple of times and then we're doing like a few thousand meals a week? And so there's like a big kind of creative slash logistical hurdle to figuring out how we can deliver the same quality product or even like improve the product over time as that scales. And so it's definitely a different muscle, but I find it like, it's super interesting.
Yeah.
And for the first time in my career, at least, it feels like a problem that when we figure out how to solve it, we actually get like a reward from it rather than this thing where it's like, how do we make this thing that's like frozen and hot, like get to the table at the same time so that it's not like, you know, it's like,
this is
like a much different
kind of problems hurdle to deal with.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. But it's like a big puzzle. For me, it's like fun to.
That's great. Awesome. Well, thank you both. This was super interesting to talk with you about both of your careers and your entrepreneurial ventures. I am super excited to see how Green Food and Jensen Ceramics continue to grow as you both have.
Awesome. Yeah, it was great chatting with you.
Great.
Enjoy Thanksgiving.
Yes.